Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel is committed to proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click on the support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Before we begin in Revelation chapter 13, I thought it would behoove us to bump over to Daniel again and get the background. So we're going to learn Daniel 7, and after learning Daniel 7, then we're going to go learn Daniel 13 rather than going to Revelation 13 and saying, well, we really need to go back to Daniel 7. So let's turn over to the book of Daniel. It's an important chapter, actually. It's a very messianic chapter. And I'm going to just read and talk the way through this whole chapter, which is quite long. So you'll have to bear with me. And if you have a Bible, follow along with me, even better. Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. And he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. So this is apropos to our Parsha, isn't it? Right? Because we're in Parsha Vayeshev, the Torah portion of Joseph the dreamer, right? That master of dreams. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea. So take note, four great beasts coming up from the sea. Different from one another. The first one was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked and it was lifted up from the ground, made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side and three ribs were in its mouth, between its teeth. And thus they said, arise, devour much meat. So we have a second beast, it's the bear. All right. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So when it says dominion was given to it, we understand this is the power of kingdom, malkut. Dominion was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, beast number four, if you're keeping track, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured, it crushed, it trampled the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts there were before it. And it had 10 horns, which is interesting. Usually a beast only has 2 horns, maybe 1 horn, maybe 2 horns, but 10 horns is way over the top, don't you think? While I was contemplating the horns, he's thinking about the horns, behold, another horn. So what would that make? 11 horns, right? A little one came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. So now what are we at? Okay, so we're down to 8 horns. And behold, this horn possessed eyes. It's a horn with eyes, like the eyes of a man in the mouth, and a mouth uttering great words, great boasts. And I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. So now we move into the Day of Judgment. We've seen four beasts, and now we're moving up to the Day of Judgment. God's taking his throne of judgment. And his vesture was like snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. Myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat and the books were opened. And so this is the sort of thing we usually study around the high holidays, right? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Book of Life, the Book of Death, the Book of the In-Between, the Books of Judgment, the heavenly courtroom. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. So we see this fourth beast is still at work. The fourth beast with the little horn is still at work as the judgment has commenced. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. And I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. So this is the Messiah. He came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before Hashem. He's presented before God. And to him was given dominion, glory, kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him, which is language we've encountered in the book of Revelation already. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So this is the kingdom of heaven. We speak of the message of the gospel all the time, the message of the kingdom. And as for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by me and began asking him the meaning of all this. So we see we're in the apocalypse mode. He's speaking to an angel now. The angel's going to give him the interpretation. He told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. So just in case you were wondering, you might have been curious about the four great beasts as we're reading through. Here you go. The four great beasts are four kings who will rise in the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. So what did you get there? You had a synopsis of history. From where Daniel is standing, he's looking forward to the kingdom of heaven. He's looking from where he's standing all the way forward up to the coming of Messiah and the establishment of the Messianic era. And the answer is there's going to be four kingdoms between now and the kingdom of Messiah that's going to be granted when the one like the Son of Man comes and all dominion is given to him. And these four kingdoms are symbolized by four beasts. So, let's learn about the four kingdoms, the four beasts. But Daniel's particularly interested in learning about the last of the four, the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, which devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the ten horns, which were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three of them fell, namely the horn which had eyes and a mouth, uttering great boasts and blasphemies, which was larger in appearance than its associates. And I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and intervened. And judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So in this is the redemption. Now we're talking about the final redemption. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise, and another will rise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue the three kings. And he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. As it says, alterations in times and in law. This is to the appointed times, to the festivals. And alterations in law, that's changes to the Torah. And they will be given into his hand, the saints, the righteous, will be given into the power of his hand for a time, times, and half a time, as we've learned over and over and over for the last couple weeks. Time, times, half a time, the 3 years, the 42 months, the 1260 days. But the court will sit in judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty and the kingdom and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom. So now we're talking about the Messianic era. And his dominion will serve, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me. My face grew pale. I kept the matter to myself. So, if we were to look through this vision then and understand the beasts, the four beasts, from their historical interpretation, this is how we understand the four beasts. The lion, the first beast, the lion that has the wings, is understood to be the kingdom of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, under which Daniel himself was deported from Jerusalem and Judea in the days of King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, remember Nebuchadnezzar in the story of the Nebuchadnezzar's great image, and everybody had to worship and pray to the image, and Daniel wouldn't worship and pray to the image. He got thrown in the lion's den and so forth, that kind of stuff. That's the first beast. The second beast is the empire, the kingdom that conquers the Babylonians, which Daniel sees more, he'll give us more on in the next chapter, chapter 8 of the book of Daniel. But that is the kingdom of Persia. That is Persia of such as Cyrus, and who initiates the return from Babylon. That's Persia such as Xerxes, Ahasuerus of Purim fame, Queen Esther, Persia, the Persian Empire, just to kind of orient you. The third beast is Alexander the Great's Greco-Hellenist empire that he obtains through his conquests and is then split into the four kingdoms under him. So this is, we just refer to this as Greece, as the Greek Empire. It's not really a Greek empire, but it's Alexander the Great's kingdom. That's the third beast. And then finally, the fourth beast, which is really the most astonishing of all to me, because at the time that Daniel was writing, he certainly knew about Babylon, and he's even still writing when the Persians take over. So those two are given. Well, given, you don't have to be a prophet to be able to tell what's happening politically currently, right? And then he could have even perhaps predicted the rise of another. The really astonishing thing is the fourth kingdom, because I really don't understand how Daniel could have had an inkling of that outside of, well, of course, it's a prophetic dream. There is that. But the fourth kingdom is clearly the Roman Empire. That's the fourth beast. Where did these four beasts come from? Again? At the beginning of the dream?
Out of the sea.
Out of the sea. All right. Now, yeah. Now we can go from Revelation. But before we do, we should just run through those 10 horns on the fourth beast. So the 10 horns are 10 kings. And so I want to provide you with my suggested list. I've got a list of the emperors, beginning with Julius Caesar and concluding with Domitian, who was the emperor at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. So that's why I selected this span. And so it's Julius Caesar, there's Augustus, Tiberius, he's the emperor in the days of the Gospels, and Acts, Gaius Caligula, Claudius, all through the book of Acts, Nero, and then Nero launches the legions against Jerusalem to crush the Jewish revolt. Nero commits suicide, and three emperors vie for power in that great civil war that I spoke about last week when I told you about how, as the earth opened its mouth to swallow the flood that was being spewed out of the dragon's mouth, the great civil war was Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Between these three emperors, not one of them lasted a year. Not one of them really could be considered to be like an emperor who had all of Rome, because it was a civil war. Then Vespasian, the conqueror of the Galilee, the one leading the Roman legions against the Jewish people, really the conqueror of Jerusalem because he left his son Titus to finish conquering Jerusalem. Vespasian then would be the 10th. So if we were to count our 10 horns, including the three that really didn't hold power, then we would come to Vespasian as the 10th. That seems really significant to me. Or if we just discount those three, because they don't really have a position, then we would come to Domitian, the emperor of the book of Revelation. Okay, now we'll go study Revelation. Thank you for indulging me in that little exercise. It'll make it easier. You'll see what I mean. Revelation chapter 13. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Now, this dragon we already met in the previous chapter, and we understood this dragon to symbolize the adversary, the devil, Satan, the ancient serpent, but to be embodied, he embodied the Roman Empire in chapter 12. And so we're going to see something very similar here. It says, then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. So now, if we hadn't gone back to Daniel 7, read about Daniel having a dream about four beasts coming out of the sea, would you have known what that meant? No, you would have thought that you probably would have thought there's really a beast that's going to come out of the sea, and it's going to be like one of those movies where you have some gigantic Japanese shogun warrior type robots to fight against this thing. But no, that's not the case. It's actually symbolic language going back to Daniel chapter 7, the vision of the four beasts. So this is one of the beasts, and in fact, we know which beast it is. This is the fourth beast coming out of the sea. So, who's coming out of the sea? It's the Roman Empire. And why is it depicted as coming out of the sea? Well, we have a very interesting parallel in rabbinic literature. This is what it says in the Talmud about the origin of Rome. It says, where did Rome come from? Here's where Rome came from. When King Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter, Hashem was displeased with this, that he was marrying this idolatrous woman, so he sent the angel Gabriel. Gabriel came down and stuck a reed in the sea. It's not a very big punishment. Comes down, sticks a reed in the sea, doesn't bother Solomon at all. But around this reed, sand starts to gather. It's pretty soon it forms the whole peninsula of Italy. And that's where Rome is built. Okay, that's obviously a folktale, a legend, not true, not real. But nevertheless, this is how, in the Jewish worldview, where does Rome come from? Rome comes out of the sea. Why? Because Israel is on the Mediterranean's eastern seaboard. You're looking across the sea. You're looking across the Mediterranean towards the west, towards Italy, towards Rome. So this beast comes up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Pretty exciting. 7 heads, 10 horns, blasphemous names. The 10 horns, we already learned, are 10 emperors. Or we can understand them as 10 emperors. It's the Roman Empire. The beast is the Roman Empire. Then we've got 10 emperors here. And we can take it two different ways. We could take it up with Vespasian being our 10th emperor, or we can cut out those middle three. We can cut out those middle three and then Domitian. That works better. It does, because we have to have we still haven't had the last one. What are these blasphemous names that are written on them? Yeah. Blasphemous names. What does that mean? Well, these guys think they're gods, and they refer to themselves with the names of gods. And they expect to be worshipped as gods, and their names to be invoked as gods. So they're blasphemous names. Remember the way it spoke about this in Daniel chapter 7. It said they made big words. The horn was speaking very boastfully. It was speaking in big terms. Those are the blasphemous names. What about the 7 heads? Well, this actually gets interpreted for us in Revelation 17:9. It'll say the 7 heads are the 7 hills on which the city sits. I don't know if you've ever heard of the city of Rome. Is called the city that sits on 7 hills. That's just something that it's known by in ancient literature. Also in Revelation 17:9, however, it makes reference to 7 kings, which is very interesting. Another way to interpret. And then finally, the 10 diadems. Which also, what's a diadem? We're talking about a crown. We're talking about the power of monarchy. Okay, I wanted to do something else, because now we're really moving into like the nitty-gritty of the book of Revelation. and understanding some of this symbolism. We're unpacking the symbolism, but I wanted to show you a comparison between the dragon that was introduced to us in Revelation 12, verse 3, where it said, a great red dragon, we know is Satan, the great red dragon has 7 heads, 10 horns, and on his heads, 7 diadems. And the beast that we meet here in Revelation 13, having 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems. So I made a little chart. You can see this little chart. 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems, the diadems on the heads. That's the dragon. Whereas the beast has 7 heads, same, 10 horns, same, 10 diadems, he's got 3 extra, and the crowns, the diadems, were on the horns. What does it mean? I don't know. But it's very interesting, and there's all sorts of different ways we can plug these names in to figure out, to try to figure these schemes and make some sense of it. It might not have even been completely clear in the days of the apostles. I think if I was, my understanding would be something along these lines. When we learned chapter 12, we saw it as a digression, a flashback. And so we'll see in chapter 12 that we have 7 heads, 10 horns, but only 7 diadems. So the 10 horns are from Daniel, yes, obviously. But since we are dealing with a flashback that goes back to the time of the Jewish revolt, we are only up to emperor number 7, which is Vespasian, cutting out the middle 3. When we get to the beast in chapter 13, we have 10 diadems bringing us up to Domitian, bringing us up to Antichrist, up to the limit. Verse 2. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Now, if we hadn't gone and read Daniel chapter 7, what would you be thinking right now? You would be thinking, I wonder if I could draw that. Right? When I was a kid, there was this game where you had these different patterns that you could put together, different shapes, features like claws or wings, and you put them together, you configure them, and then you use this rubbing, like a pencil rubbing, to create your different monsters. It was called Mighty Men. What? Yeah, you remember Mighty Men and Monster Maker, and then there was also superheroes that you could reconfigure like this. So this sort of looks like that. This is some sort of reconfiguration. You know, you're going to make this beast. Well, it's like a liger. It has right? It's a leopard, it's a bear, it's a lion. But really, we already have learned from Daniel chapter 7 that what these are referring to are the previous 3 empires. So when we're speaking of the beast, the fourth beast, possessing attributes of the original 3, it means that it has taken their power. It's taken the power of the earlier empires. And perhaps their territory as well. And the dragon gave this beast his power and his throne and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? The way that this has always traditionally been interpreted, and I have no reason to suspect that it's incorrect, this is very old interpretation, is that the head that receives the wound is actually slain, is a fatal wound, and then healed and restored, amazing the whole earth so that they follow after the beast, is symbolic of Nero. Nero was the false messiah of the days of Peter and Paul. Nero was the antichrist that started the persecution against the believers after the fire of Rome. And so Nero was looked at by the early believers as this must be false messiah. We thought it was Gaius Caligula a while ago, but it turned out not to be. It's definitely Nero. And so they understood Nero as the beast, as the Antichrist. But then guess what happened? I mean, Nero starts to do, everything's coming together. Nero sends the Roman legions to attack the land of Israel, to destroy the city of Jerusalem. It's all very clearly, Nero is the bad guy. He's the baddie, okay? This is the one that Jesus warned us about, right? That's Nero. But then something unexpected happens. Nero commits suicide. And then we have these three guys, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and then Vespasian and so forth. But after Nero's death, a rumor went around the Roman Empire that he wasn't really dead. He was like Elvis. There were Nero sightings. I'm not kidding. There were Nero sightings and people and imposters who would claim to be Nero. There was one Nero imposter who raised an army on by telling people, I'm Nero. And I'm back. I'm taking Rome back. And in addition, you had sort of like the conspiracy theory societies were picking this up as well. So we, for example, we could read in the prophecies of the Sibylline oracles, it speaks about the emperor who killed his mother coming back to life. And this is first century stuff. So there was an expectation in the days of the apostles of Nero coming back to life. Or being reborn, or maybe just a second Nero coming around. Another Nero, a new Antichrist. So this is how we understand, this would be the explanation then of these words, where it says, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. So this is the little horn that we saw in Daniel 7. And now, in Revelation 13, it's being referred to as the restored horn. So, what did they do? They worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast. What does it mean they worshiped the beast? Do people really worship Rome? Yes. Rome even had its own goddess. Guess what her name was? Rome. And there were temples to her all over. Actually, Roma, but that's what Rome was, Roma. The goddess Roma has her temples everywhere. But not only that, but also each Caesar, each emperor has a temple. He gets a temple. And not only that, but you're supposed to offer sacrifice. We've talked about the tribunals and standing in front of the tribunals, and you're supposed to offer incense and oblations and so forth. All you have to do is just renounce the name of Yeshua and burn some incense and pour out this cup of wine to this statue of Domitian. How hard is that? How hard is that going to be to do, right? So this is all going on. And Domitian, interesting thing about Domitian is that he was really, really into his image. So much so, more so than anyone who had ever gone before him in terms of emperors, he had his image plastered everywhere. Now, Nero had a great colossus of his image erected after the fire of Rome. Enormous, enormous statue of himself put up in Rome. Kind of like the Happy Chef, if you remember that.
Like, bigger than Nebuchadnezzar?
Yeah. Yeah, as big as Nebuchadnezzar. His image. That's the image of the beast in the days of Nero. This giant statue. But Domitian, he didn't have a giant statue. Instead, he had his image put up everywhere, with the instruction that everybody was to refer to him as my Lord and my God, right? And so this is Domitian's approach to things. And so the believers are looking at this and saying, you know, he's a lot like Nero. This is a lot like Nero again. This is like the second coming of Nero with this guy. And not only that, but his dad is the one who led the legions against Jerusalem. And not only that, but his older brother, Titus, is the one who burned the temple. And now he's singling us out for persecution. So yes, we have these imposters. And here's just a quote from Eusebius in Ecclesiastical History. He says, Domitian had already demonstrated great cruelty toward many by the time John wrote this. He unjustly put to death large numbers of aristocratic and notable men at Rome. Why? He was accusing them of being Jewish or believers. Without just cause, he exiled and confiscated the property of a great many other illustrious men. So some he put to the sword, right? And others he exiled, right? Finally, he became a successor to Nero in his hatred and enmity toward God. He was, in fact, the second emperor to stir up a persecution against us, that is, against the believers, although his father, Vespasian, had done nothing to single us out. So you're seeing the relationship between Nero and Domitian very clearly. It's spelled out for you here by Eusebius. Verse 4 says, they worshipped the dragon because he gave authority to the beast. They worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? This is what everybody said about Rome all the time. If we had time, I would like to read you a speech by Agrippa II. You could have titled the speech, who is able to wage war with Rome? This is when he was trying to dissuade the Jewish people from embarking on the perilous course of revolt against Rome. He went through a list of nations that have tried to fight against Rome. Rome was the largest, most powerful military machine that humanity had ever known. So that's what you would say. Who can wage war against Rome? And when it says, who is like the beast? This, of course, reminds us of Exodus chapter 15, like we say in our liturgy every day between the Shema and the Amidah. We say, who is like Hashem? Who is like the Lord? Mighty in holiness, too awesome for praise. A liturgical refrain from Exodus has been turned upside down here, where the people are saying, who is like the beast? Who is like Rome? It goes on and says, there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words, just like we see in Daniel 7 regarding the little horn, and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. There's our 3.5 years. Time times half a time, 42 months. 3.5 years, 1,260 days, no matter how you want to slice it. 6 one way, half dozen another, right? 42 months. So I was wondering about this 42 months. Last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago or something like that, I was telling you about the 42 months. How long is it? We have to understand these 42 months last to this very day because the Messiah still hasn't come, right? So it's like it symbolizes the exile. It symbolizes the last 2,000 years we're waiting for Messiah. You know, we're kind of on pause here, right? So it symbolizes the wilderness. Troy brought up that beautiful connection about there are 42 encampments in the wilderness, it says at the end of the book of Bamidbar, the end of the book of Numbers, right? Okay, so there's that. On the other hand, I think the apostolic community was looking for a really solid 42-month period of time. They were looking for a literal 3.5 years, and hence the emphasis on Elijah was a man just like us. He sealed up the heavens and it didn't rain for 3.5 years. Hence the emphasis on this, you know, saying time, times, half a time, 42 months, 1,260 days, 3.5 years. I thought I'd throw out a couple 42-month periods for you. For one thing, there's from the fire of Rome in the beginning of the Neronian persecution until the death of Nero, 3.5 years. Another, the Jewish revolt, starting in 66 Common Era, ending with the destruction of the temple in 70 Common Era, 3.5 years. Another, and this comes from rabbinic literature, 3.5 years did the Shekinah, the dwelling presence of God, remain on the Mount of Olives after leaving the Temple Mount. This is just an interesting tradition to show you that this was an idea in Judaism as well, these 3.5 year periods. But the point of all that is to say that at the end of 3.5 years then, at the end of the 42 months, at the end of the time in which the Gentiles are to trample down the courts of Jerusalem, what is supposed to happen? The Messiah is supposed to come. So, I think he's late. Right, that's a problem. This is a problem. Where is the coming of Messiah? It should have been like several centuries ago, minus 42 months, you know. And so, Yehiel Tzvi Lichtenstein takes this problem up in his commentary on the book of Revelation. And he spends several pages discussing this very issue. And so I just give you a very short quote from that discussion. He says, thus we see that the full redemption will occur during the siege of Jerusalem. The way that he's interpreting it is that the Messiah should come
during the war with Rome, which has already not happened by the time John is writing this, by the way. You know, because John's like writing this in the 90s. So Liechtenstein's interpreting this to say, well, it looks here like it should have come in the 70s. Zechariah also prophesied about this in chapter 12 and 13. But the prophecy in the prophets and the prophecy in Revelation were not fulfilled then. Rather, they will be fulfilled in the last days, for the word of Hashem will not fail. The only change is in time, for the redemption is delayed for some reason. And then he goes on to give his explanation of why the redemption is delayed. It's a long discussion. Basically, he says, you needed 144,000, and there weren't 144,000, and we're still waiting. So that's his explanation. But the real important point is that the redemption has been delayed, and it's already in this state of delay when John is writing in the 90s that Messiah should be back by now. And so we're seeing this time, times, and half a time stretch from 3.5 years to the last 2,000 years as we're waiting for the culmination of that seventh trumpet blast. And because remember, this is all what's to come. This is the future that's to come. Is this the last trumpet blasts, the bowls that are yet to be poured out on the earth, and so forth. Pretty much everything that is ahead of us in the book of Revelation. So it goes on then in verse 6. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, his temple. That is, those who dwell in heaven. It was given to him to make war with the saints, to overcome them. Which is just a repetition of what we were learning last week in chapter 12. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And all who dwell on earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life, in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. We're speaking about the tribunals, the persecution of the believers. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. Remember what Domitian was doing. It says, without just cause, he exiled people and confiscated property. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he is to be killed. And likewise, he unjustly put to death large numbers. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. So the book of Revelation, we must never forget, is being written not primarily for us, but primarily for the people suffering under the Neronian persecution. It gives us a future hope in the redemption, but also a sort of sad fatalism here for those who are going to persecution. If you're destined for exile, better to be exiled than to renounce the name of Yeshua and to worship the beast. If you're destined for the sword, better to be destined for the sword and to go to the sword than to renounce the name of Yeshua and to worship the beast. Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.